Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. California has long been home to wildfires, with burn scars and charred terrain that last well beyond devastating flames. There are too many to count, and each are deeply personal to those who have suffered loss. But November 8th, 2018, defied the gravity and the veracity of a wildfire in California. We now know the Camp Fire as the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in state history. 85 people were killed that day, and more than 18,000 homes and other structures were destroyed in the days that followed. But rankings and numbers fall short of what was truly taken. For the more than 50,000 people in Paradise, Magalia, Concal, Polga, and other communities who were lucky to evacuate and survive, life didn't simply return to normal. And for those who chose to return to rebuild, it has been a long, hard-fought road to regain a sense of home. One of those survivors is Jenna Baker, who was working at an assisted living facility that fateful morning and helped senior residents escape. 5 years later, Jenna still calls Paradise and Magalia home, and she joins us now. Welcome, Jenna. It's nice to see you.
Hi, Vicky. Long time no see.
I know. I'll lead with you and I go way back. So our listeners know I met you while covering the campfire. I was a reporter at KCRA and you graciously opened up your life to me and to viewers in the year following the campfire. It was part of a documentary called Return to Paradise. And that was back in 2019. One of the positive parts about social media and Facebook is that we've been able to keep in touch over the years. But you and I have never really talked about the campfire since then. So my first question is, how are you feeling about today? How are you doing?
Mixed emotions. Of course, I'm really grateful for being able to look back these 5 years. Sad at what happened, of course. My husband and I were going back, you know, moment by moment this morning before he left for work, and where we were at this moment and this moment. And then lost touch, and it was a little harrowing, but now, I mean, it's a sunny day. The wind is slightly fierce this morning, which is a little bit, you know, trepidating, but it's a beautiful day and it's a great day to be alive. And I'm thankful for that day. You know, I'm thankful for surviving and I'm thankful for all my staff and family and everything. I still keep in touch with all of them. So
that's wonderful. How are you and friends and neighbors? How are you all coming together this week?
So there are a lot of events happening today. As a matter of fact, at 11:08, there's going to be that 85 seconds of silence. Throughout the week, we've been having small events. I shouldn't say small. Our community is still growing. So it's not as big as it was, you know, before the fire, but we are growing. Actually, at one of the parks, they are having that 85 seconds of silence. And then this evening, they're doing a special on one of the news stations. Tomorrow, there is going to be a big dinner at CMA Church where they're going to really reflect and everything. There have been daffodil plantings that I went to. There have been just small get-togethers throughout the entire community. They really come together, which it makes me proud to be here. I've only been here for 11 years, and I really feel like I've been welcomed, especially this last 5 years, you know?
Yeah. And you've stayed since the campfire. And I wonder how each year feels during these weeks, because it seems like you all really get together and support each other during a week and a time that marks something that was so traumatic. And it helps. It's a silver lining to something, you know, so terrible that happened.
Right. So the first year was the hardest, of course. It was still really raw and everything was burnt and black. The entire landscape was black and white, literally. Now there's green, there are rebuilds, there are brand new homes and communities and new friends and old friends. And a lot of my friends actually stayed and rebuilt. Others decided that it was too traumatic to stay, which of course I understand. My whole take was that 2 days after we had evacuated, I had just purchased my home 4 months before the fire. So in my very first home. So I was determined Oh no, we're coming back. We're rebuilding. So we've been in our home now 3 years. And I love it here. I love the wildlife. I love the camaraderie. I love all the community events that have been going on. I love that Paradise and Magalia have now, they have restarted all of their old festivals, like Gold Nugget Days, Johnny Appleseed Days. I did a cook-off recently. It's fun to participate in all of the new events now, and a lot of people come out for it, which is it's helpful and it's kind and it's endearing, and it really brings heart back to this quaint little area that we all loved, 5 years ago and even now.
Yeah, that's wonderful to hear because I visited the area over the years and rebuilding has been so slow. But it's great to hear that things are coming back, especially community events and festivals. I saw you post like a trunk or treat for Halloween. That's a lot of fun too. What does Paradise and the surrounding communities like Magalia, what does it look like today? How much has it grown?
Well, I'm the only house on our cul-de-sac. People have decided not to rebuild, and that's okay. But there are tremendous small neighborhoods where people have rebuilt right next to each other. Just going up the street towards Skyway from our house, you can see like four or five, six homes that have gone up. And the bulk of them are the manufactured. They're not necessarily stick built, but I think that might be an insurance thing as well. But yeah, it's coming. And the homes are beautiful. The new layouts are wonderful. And thanks to new rebuild requirements as well, you have to have fire sprinklers now. You have to, have, X amount of defensible space. You have to, so they're really taking this seriously, to that if we have to endure another fire, at least we are better prepared.
I mean, just because a campfire happened doesn't mean life's challenges that they stop, right? And I wonder if rebuilding was more difficult than you imagined. I mean, obviously there was a pandemic wedged in between this. There were supply chain shortages, inflation, interest rates, and you mentioned insurance as well. It's been very difficult for people to get insurance, especially in rural areas like this, which are at risk of wildfires. I mean, how did you navigate all of those unexpected hurdles?
So I continued to live in the trailer, in the fifth wheel for an extensive period of time, whereas, I had to do dialysis and all that fun stuff. And the interest rates didn't really affect me too much, only because I reinvested my insurance money that I'd received straight into the house. So I just continued to pay my mortgage, and it didn't affect me at all. So a lot of people with their rebuild, I don't know how that affected them per se, but I know people now trying to come in and rebuild, the interest rates are significantly stifling their dreams of rebuilding, which is slowing the process. Still a beautiful place to live now that all the trees have been, the dead trees have been removed, and the underground, PG&E underground is now being placed, which is, not gonna lie, it is a slight inconvenience. However, it is all for the greater good. But yeah, a lot of my friends stayed, a lot rebuilt, and rebuilt better. They're more stable, and again with the defensible space. But yeah, I love our house.
You talked about dialysis. I remember in the year that you and I, we got very close and you let me be a fly on the wall of your life. You had serious kidney issues after the campfire. You were on dialysis, as you mentioned, while you were living in an RV and you were in need of a kidney donor, all while rebuilding and healing from trauma. I mean, that's a tremendous level of adversity to overcome in a very short amount of time. What did that teach you and how did that shape you?
I felt that I learned the meaning of resiliency. Huge. That was gonna be, I should have, had that penned as my middle name. But since then, I don't, 1 in 2 million, I guess this happens too, but my kidneys ended up waking up. So I no longer, not only didn't need a donor anymore, I no longer had to do dialysis anymore in the trailer, which I was doing peritoneal dialysis. People don't realize there are two different kinds of dialysis. So I ended up marrying my kidney donor, and he's the love of my life. And he always teases that now he's my backup plan. So I told him, I married you for your heart, not your kidney. So we're celebrating our 4 year anniversary on leap day, which will technically be our 1 year anniversary because it was leap day. So
That is wonderful. And, and those moments are so special, especially when you have the perspective of everything that you had to overcome to get to these beautiful moments. And when it comes to what home is, I mean, it's the people, right? It's not necessarily the buildings or the structure. You helped us visualize what Paradise Megalia, what it looks like today. How does it feel today for you?
It feels more and more like home every day. It More businesses are popping up, more local businesses are coming back. And more people want to talk now than maybe before. They, there's a hi, how you doing? And the handshake. The pandemic kind of ruined that for a minute. But now that we're over that, people are way friendlier. They're I think that we're getting back to a place that we were pre-fire. And then there's always that before the fire, after the fire. All of us do it. Oh, I had this. Oh, whoops, that was before the fire, or this is how we felt before the fire. Or so I think we are getting to the point now, slowly but steadily, that we're getting back to that point of love that, the sign says it all. May paradise be everything its name implies, that's where we need to get back. And I feel like we are slowly getting there.
And you described in tremendous detail to me what you went through that day 5 years ago, escaping, surrounded by flames, getting senior residents out of the assisted living facility, all while not knowing where your own family was. How do you reflect on that time? Have your memories softened or have they evolved since then?
I think, well, back then I was really in fight or flight mode. That's why I don't have any video or pictures of that time, because I was so concentrated on my residents in my car. They have softened. I have maintained relationships with those families that I had their residents in my car with me. I'm grateful. I learned a lot. I have love for everyone that went through that and everyone that survived. My heart breaks for those that didn't. But I still, I know as of October 31st, I no longer work for Sunshine Assisted Living, but it's be only because I moved on. I had to, go for other passions. But they are the best and only senior living facility in Paradise, and I'd like to give them props. I gave them a decade of my life, literally a decade. So not to say I'd like to do it all over again, but I would evacuate the residents all over again.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Jenna Baker, who survived the 2018 Camp Fire, which happened 5 years ago today, and still calls the area home. Jenna, as we all now know, PG&E admitted to causing the Camp Fire. The utility giant pled guilty to murder, 84 counts of manslaughter. I went to that trial and I covered it, in addition to a settlement totaling billions of dollars. How does the cause of the wildfire, the outdated, ill-maintained power lines, how does that shape what healing is for you, as well as for your friends and neighbors who went through this and still call the area home?
So I know that every single person that I've spoken with, everyone that I talk to, we are still mad, obviously. We are we're angry because it could have been prevented. But we might never have closure, and that's okay. We just have to accept and move on. As I like to say a lot, our words create our worlds. So if you put good out, you're going to get good back. So if you're just negative all the time and you blame PG&E for every this, that, and the other thing, you're not going to live a happy life. So I'm glad that they are being punished for their wrongdoing. I'm glad that it wasn't more than the 85. But I'm trying to put it behind me as it's a remembrance day for me now. It's no longer as painful as it was. I don't want to think about that. I used to have this and oh, now I got to go on Amazon and buy it. I love this area. I moved here from the Bay Area where it was very fast paced and just people were not so nice a lot of the time. Here, everyone was friendly, and I just want to get back to that. I just, this place is like a warm hug.
Yeah. And so are you. I mean, you're known for your smile and your sunshine, and that remains bright to this day. And you work hard to keep that alive. Given that it's not only the campfire in the last 6 years where, I mean, that has been devastating for people across the state when it comes to wildfires. And you have really managed to overcome, trauma and hardship and keep that sunshine and keep that laughter and that smile. Do you have advice about how to move forward when, as you say, like closure in a simplistic form, I mean, it is impossible.
Yeah, none of us, I think, will ever have closure. We will never be made whole, as they say. What I do, and I make a, it's, it, I made a habit of it, is find three things today that make you smile. Recite those three things. Did the sun come out today? Did your clothes match? Did your dog wag its tail at you? Anything? Did your goat bay at you? When you saw it.
You
So,
have goats.
just I have goats. Three things that make you smile throughout the day that'll carry you through. And if you do that for 21 days, it'll become a habit.
I love that. I'm going to start doing that too. Finally, Jenna, what would you like people to take away and keep in mind when they think about the campfire?
Just recall that it now became part of a community. It's made us more, I don't want to say lovable, but it's made us more compassionate, and we understand the plights of others that maybe we didn't before. Just try to carry happiness with you throughout the day. It's not that hard to smile. It takes more muscles to frown, right? So, yeah, just smile.
Jenna, it's great to see you, and I'm happy that you're doing so well.
Thank you, Vicky. It's been so great to talk to you.
Jenna Baker survived the 2018 campfire, which happened 5 years ago today, and still calls Paradise and Magalia home. Up next, we're going to stay in Butte County on the 5 years marking the campfire. The superintendent of Paradise Unified School District joins us about the strides they've made for some of the youngest wildfire survivors. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're focusing a big portion of our show on the campfire, which ignited 5 years ago today. 85 people were killed in the immediate aftermath, and tens of thousands of others were displaced. As we heard from our previous guest, for those who chose to return and rebuild, recovery has come with many hurdles, and it is far from over. The campfire also had a devastating impact on education in the towns of Paradise, Magalia, and surrounding communities. Butte County schools suffered a lot of damage. Six schools were destroyed. Another eight were severely damaged. Roughly 5,000 students and more than 500 teachers in the county lost their homes as well. And that led to major disruption in the 2018-2019 school year. According to our content sharing partners, CalMatters, there were over 150 school closure days for Paradise Unified School District, and Chico Unified nearby was also closed closed for more than 280 school days, affecting tens of thousands of students and teachers. The level of learning loss was just staggering. And then, of course, a year and a half later, the pandemic happened. Joining us now to talk about how the schools in the area have rebuilt, modernized, and are coming back stronger is the superintendent of Paradise Unified School District, Tom Taylor. Good morning, Tom. Superintendent Taylor, actually.
Tom is fine. So
I want to start with the motto of Paradise Unified School District. It's every student matters, every moment counts. What does that mean to you, the students, the staff, and the teachers, you know, when it comes to rebuilding in the years since the campfire?
Well, I think it points out that students are our priority and that all students are different. And it doesn't matter who the student is, any differences, that every student matters and every student is important. And the idea that every moment counts is, you know, that we only have limited time with the students and that every minute inside the classroom is critical. And even beyond that, every one of your words that you use during that time is critical. And we know that from the campfire, we have our students who are recovering and they need support, and teachers, staff, you know, aides, whatever your position might be, you're also their counselor and their friend and their, you know, somebody who can help turn their day from something negative to something positive. Mm.
You are more, or this is more than a job for you. I mean, you have such deep ties to Paradise, to this community. I mean, you went to school there. I believe your wife and two of your daughters are teachers there. You're a superintendent as well. You've spent decades in this community. What kept you wanting to continue calling Paradise home?
It's home, you know, and I feel like, and I think I can say this for the majority of our staff, that, you know, it's a privilege to be able to serve the community and, you know, and be part of what's happening within our community. And when I say within our community, I don't just mean within the school system, but really within the whole town, all the way Paradise up to Sterling City, you know, which is our district, you know, and it is, there's a group of people, and we heard a little bit earlier that just it's their home and they want to stay and they're going to be here, and there's some that left, and that's okay. Either one is okay, but you know, for people that are still here, you know, it's a privilege to be able to serve the community. And with that said, I have to say that I'm not one of the individuals that lost our home. Many of my family members did, but I did not lose my home, and so once again, feel extremely blessed about that. But, you know, the idea that we can serve our community and be part of really an incredible thing that's going on growth and of our community. Hmm.
You became superintendent actually in 2020, but you had been with the school district for many years before that. Can you kind of help us visualize the level of devastation that the district had to overcome following the campfire, especially when it comes to students and all of the teachers who are impacted and staff?
Yeah, you know, it was huge. You know, within days after the fire, there was talk of Paradise Unified School District not existing. The conversation was, let's put everybody needs to enroll their kids in other communities, school districts. And of course, you know, we had one school that was not damaged by the fire. And that was Cedarwood. So we were able to keep students there. Doesn't mean that they didn't have damage, you know, mm-hmm. in their hearts and in their minds, you know, from the devastation, but the school wasn't damaged. And, you know, we had really nowhere to put students because we couldn't come back up the hill. Mm-hmm. So we had, you know, I think right around the time of the return of the fire, we were probably around 1,600. We went from 3,400 students down to about 1,600, I think, immediately following. And then we dropped a couple years after that. So you had a decrease of about 50% of your enrollment and nowhere to put your students. And thanks to a great staff, you know, there was a scramble to find buildings. You guys heard about the, you know, the fortress building, which is what it was called, for the high school down at the airport. You heard about the junior high going to having school in a hardware store. You know, it was a vacant hardware store. And, other school districts allowing us to move our students down to their campuses where we were able to put some portables and just some of our students in vacant classrooms. So it was really an incredible effort of, finding locations for students and staff to be. And it was an effort of every staff member that returned with us.
What is enrollment now, 5 years later?
Yeah, you know, we're seeing a comeback, and it's great to see, you know, just as our community is growing, so is our enrollment. We're right now at about 1,668 students. So we dropped all the way down into the 1,400s. So we've seen an increase at about 5% over the last number of years, which is higher than what our projection was. And so we hope to see that over the next 3 years or next number of years. Mm-hmm. But if it continues, we have a 3-year projection now of 5%. So, continuing to grow at, levels that we are, have not expected. In fact, we are starting to have conversations of rebuilding Paradise Elementary School.
That's great. That's a good step.
Yes, it is.
That's a wonderful step. You know that school is so much more than academics, and, you know, after a time like the campfire, and the trauma that followed, you know, how did your role as a superintendent, teachers as educators, you know, staff who care about students on campus, how did your roles and your purpose evolve in that time to take care of these kids?
Yeah. You know, I don't think the purpose changed much, because it was to take care of kids. And, you know, from the level of the district office, and Michelle John was superintendent at that point and doing an incredible job. And, you know, our purpose was to take care of our staff and our students. But, you know, is what happened is we were all, the teachers were taking care of students who had been traumatized, and they were also traumatized themselves along with everybody else in the community. And so you were, you know, working not only on your own mental health, but finding ways to support the kids. And that came within, you know, we brought in organizations to help support us, additional counseling. We brought in programs such as RULER, which we're still using now, which is a social emotional wellness program. And it basically just provides strategies that teachers can use in this classroom to help students with their social emotional well-being, and also strategies that students can use for their own personal well-being. So you went from really focusing on academics, and teachers have always, and when I say teachers, I mean our entire staff, classified, certificated administrators, you've always been somebody who is somewhat of a counselor, but that role increased incredibly. In fact, that really became our main priority for a number of years. And of course, now, you know, we've had the pandemic and everything, and along with this came a loss of learning, and we're making a shift back, but we still know that there is an importance to everybody's emotional health and wellness.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point. I mean, I remember in 2019, because Paradise High School was largely intact, and I remember homecoming for 2019. It was wonderful. It was less than a year after the campfire had started, and you just saw so many people come back. It was so enriching for I mean, it's hard to really quantify how important that moment was. I could just see it was palpable for people who called Paradise and surrounding communities home. And that was fall of 2019. And obviously, we know what happened the following year. You know, how much, or was it a setback? I would imagine that it did have a significant impact on students when the pandemic happened, and a lot of the classrooms, you know, largely went virtual, remote learning.
Yeah, you know, what we strongly heard right after the fire, and what motivated us as a staff, I believe, was we heard from families, parents, kids, that we needed to be together. Teachers, aides, they needed to be with the students. The students needed to be with their teachers and their aides and their friends. And so we know that connectedness is huge. It's a big part of it. And, you know, there was, like you mentioned, there were some home football games, homecoming and things like that, that really brought the community together. And it just demonstrated how important it is for people to be together, you know, especially after they've been separated. And then the pandemic hit and it did the opposite. You know, we had online school, and it's just, you can't make the same, I fully believe, you can't make the same connections online as you can in person. So it was a struggle, and we saw that within our students. And you know, it prompted additional even counseling and programs to on top of what we were already doing. So it had a major impact. And you know, that's and we realized that happened across the world. It wasn't just Paradise that was experiencing that from COVID.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Tom Taylor. He is the superintendent of the Paradise Unified School District. So I want to talk about the strides that the school district has made. Can you give us a sense of the modernization of the schools, technologies, and the facilities that have taken place in the 5 years since the campfire, what it looks like today?
Yeah, you know, I mean, you have to look for the silver lining in this, right? And earlier, you know, I heard Jenna mention that, you know, you go through the community now and you start seeing new homes popping up, small neighborhoods, you know, and so you look for that, you look for the positive. And within the school district, you know, we really tried to focus on how we could create the greatest schools for, you know, for our students. And so over the past number of years, we haven't rebuilt Paradise Elementary. We lost four schools, and then every other school was damaged except for one. So considerable damage throughout the district. But since then, we have been able to modernize Paradise Ridge Elementary School. So, I mean, you walk on that campus and it really looks like a new school. We've been able to modernize about 60% of the junior high. And when I say modernize, we're talking taking these buildings down to the studs and then, you know, rebuilding them. At the high school, we put in there's a 31,000 square foot 19 classroom building that's brand new, which houses by far the majority of our kids. We updated all the science labs and the library. The Ridgeview High School, which is now built across the street from the high school, is a brand new high school, which is just an incredible facility for our Ridgeview students. On the Upper Ridge, we have just finished, actually not completely finished, but we're almost done, Pine Ridge Elementary School. And that has been completely modernized with the classrooms, just 21st century learning, you know, in the classrooms. And our school our other elementary school on the Upper Ridge is Cedarwood. And our Cedarwood students currently are at Pine Ridge. They're sharing that campus while the Cedarwood campus is being really rebuilt. Up at Cedarwood, all the classrooms were portables. And so we've removed the portables and we're putting all permanent structures up there. So there's been about, I would say close to about $112 million of construction just in the school district. And our schools were old. You mentioned how long I've been in the district. In 1984, when I graduated, the bathrooms looked just like they did just before the fire. And, you know, our kids now, you know, they deserve the quality of classrooms that they're getting. And it's an opportunity that we need to take advantage of and be sure that we're serving the kids and serving the community in the best way we can with the best facilities.
On your homepage, you know, there's an announcement that the district is hiring. You know, what does retention and recruitment look like for hiring teachers and staff? Are you doing okay?
Yeah, you know, there's a nationwide shortage on teachers, and we're feeling it. And the pandemic really created a huge part of that. On top of that, within our community, we lost, you know, way over half of our workforce, right? Because the population of just Paradise alone went from about 26,000 down to about, you know, we're at about 9,600 right now. So that's just a huge loss of, and every business is experiencing it, but of possible people in our workforce. So we lost that. So we are struggling with that. We have our classroom staffed with our teachers, but we do definitely need a classified staff in some areas and some of our and substitutes. If you're interested in doing something like that, please let us know. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I'm learning from you is that there are tugs and pulls of progress and challenges, and you and others with the district are writing that out, and you're in the thick of it. You know, finally, Superintendent Taylor, I mean, given that you've lived in Paradise your whole life, I mean, you attended Paradise Elementary, then Paradise High School, you graduated in 1984, as you mentioned, you know, you have four children, your wife's a teacher, so are two of your daughters, and this comes from your bio. Even after everything that you have been through and loved ones and neighbors, can you talk about what it means for you and your family to still be part of this community and to be committed to recovery and building it back?
Yeah. You know, it's an incredible privilege, as I mentioned earlier. And, you know, our family is committed to, you know, two of my kids are out of the area, but two have stayed. And as you said, they're teaching, and they, you know, they feel very committed to the community, and they love serving the children of our community and look at it as a great privilege. You know, in 1984, as a high school student, I don't think my high school teachers would have sat there and said, "Oh, Tommy Taylor is going to be superintendent of Paradise Unified School District," you know, and I wouldn't have either. But it's, you know, it's definitely, you know, a privilege for me to give back to the community in the way that I've been able to help. And by no means am I the reason things are happening within our school district like they are. We have an incredible team that makes all this happen. And I think they would say the same thing. It's just a privilege to be able to be here and be part of it and serve the entire community.
Tom, thank you so much for taking the time. It was great talking with you.
Thank you, and take care.
Tom Taylor is the superintendent of the Paradise Unified School District. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. On the second Wednesday of each month, the G Street Wonder Bar in Davis hosts a casual conversation about science. Since 2012, the Davis Science Cafe has provided a space for academics to talk about their work with the general public, everything from milk and wine to geometry, coral reefs, and even the science of love. This evening, the Science Cafe will be celebrating a big accomplishment, 100 events, and marking its centennial is a conversation called Why Are Faces Different? Genes, the Environment, and Embryonic Development. Here to talk about the series' past, present, and future is Dr. Jared Shaw, the founder and the host of the Davis Science Cafe and a chemistry professor at UC Davis. And joining Dr. Shaw is tonight's guest speaker, Dr. Crystal Rogers, an associate professor in the Department of Anatomy, Physiology, and Cell Biology at UC Davis. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
This is a big moment. So in 2012, when you started the Davis Science Cafe, Dr. Shaw, did you think you would be here with 100 events in 2023?
You know, probably not. It was a pretty small event at first. I had to spend a lot of time advertising and getting people to show up, and it was very difficult to find speakers. And at our first venue, I even had to haul my own AV equipment in and out. So it felt like a lot of work then that would be tough to maintain, but it gathered momentum, and here we are.
So what exactly, for those who haven't attended, what is a science cafe, and how did you come up with this idea?
Yeah, that's a great question. Science Cafe is a global phenomenon. So, you know, you can look up the Wikipedia or go to sciencecafes.org and find out where there are science cafes. They're all around the world. And the central sort of tenet of Science Cafe is that it's a conversation and not a lecture. And so in its original inception, speakers are supposed to just have a microphone or not and no slides. In the modern era, I think people like to have some visuals, especially with, you know, Professor Rogers. We're going to see some hopefully cute pictures of axolotls and things like that. And that all goes over better with more than a microphone. As far as our event, I started it as an annual event in the UC Davis Arboretum as part of a project to get exhibits installed in the Arboretum. And it was an idea that was pitched to me by someone who worked at the UC Davis Arboretum. And so that was annual. And then after that grant period ended, I wrote it into my next grant as a monthly event. And so it's persisted since then.
And the rest is history. And it's evolved to now restaurants and now the G Street Wonder Bar. What is it about the atmosphere and the environment of having it in a bar, having a casual conversation about a myriad of topics related to science?
Yeah. You know, given that it's a conversation and not a lecture, we don't want to try to get people to come on campus to a lecture hall and sit there like they're in class. We want to come to people in an environment where people naturally want to gather. And so I think it's really that sort of special environment, the casual atmosphere and sort of the mission to make it an accessible event where a relatively obscure science topic might suddenly have meaning. You might learn why is it important to study particle physics or chemistry for that matter. So I think by going out into the community and creating a welcoming environment, you know, that's not a classroom is really what makes it work.
Yeah, because a classroom can feel intimidating for some people or a lot of people, you know, so having it in kind of a casual setting like a restaurant or bar, I think kind of lessens that intimidation. Dr. Rogers, it brings me to you. You're tonight's guest speaker. What excites you about taking part and participating in something like Davis Science Cafe?
I think that science communication is really important. And I think that as somebody who didn't come from a scientific background and none of my parents or family members studied science, it's really important to communicate what we do in a way that other people can understand, as opposed to communicating what we do to other scientists who speak the same jargon, the same, you know, coded language. And so I'm really excited about it. I just attended my first Science Cafe last month, but I know that Dr. Shaw had asked me to do this during the shutdown, during the pandemic, and it just got pushed off. But I think that's great because now I have cool pictures and, you know, I'm a little more comfortable and settled in Davis and able to talk about what we do.
You mentioned that you're a first generation scholar. I mean, talk to us about why it's so important to provide that visibility and that inspiration for those who may be looking to follow in your footsteps, but didn't even maybe know it was possible.
Absolutely. I grew up loving science and no one I knew did anything even remotely related to science. So I assumed that if you love science, you have to be a medical doctor. So I went to college with the idea that, well, I guess I'm going to be a doctor. I don't really like treating people or, you know, illness is not my jam. But I thought that's just what you have to do. And I realized while I was at UCLA that everybody in science doesn't then go on to medical school. And also my GPA said you're not going to medical school. So I think that with the guidance, this would have been a much easier journey. If somebody else had known what I wanted to do, they could have directed me to graduate school right away. But instead, I sort of found my way and I took the opportunities that were provided and I got lucky often. And I had a great set of mentors that sort of directed me to consider graduate school. And so I think it's really important to show that even if you don't have the resources, financial or the knowledge of the system, there are people who are willing to help, and finding that community is crucial. And maintaining that community and connection helps with the retention in the field. And so I guess it's important for me to show out and show that if I can make it here, you can too.
That's wonderful. And now you're going to be talking, you know, at a casual science conversation at the cafe. So the topic is, why are faces different? Genes, the environment, and embryonic development. What are you planning to talk about? Can you give us a little teaser?
Sure. I decided that I would talk a little bit about my own journey in science first. I think that it's important to know where I started and where I come from to understand how I got to where I am now. And I would say that comparatively, I'm a relatively local girl. So I am originally from Santa Rosa, California, which is about 60 miles west of here. And it's really rare in academia to be able to settle essentially near home as a professor. No, most of the time we have to move around and I've been so lucky to be here. And so I wanted to talk about my journey and how I got here and how I became the kind of scientist that I am. But I'm also going to talk a little bit about developmental biology, and that's the field that I'm in. I am a dev bio ride or die scientist. So basically I love the field. It's just so cool. And we get to study, you know, how single cells become complex organisms and all of the steps in between. And it turns out that that's a really complex process. And so I'll talk a little bit about the science of the cells that make faces and what controls their development. And then how we understand, at least what we understand now about how faces can be different in similar species, so in humans, but also in animal models.
Mm. And you actually have a pretty robust Twitter or X following. How did that get started? It seems like a lot of other people like developmental biology as well.
I think it's a great community. So I'll start with DevBio. It's a fantastic community. I would say it's one of the most welcoming. When I was in graduate school, I struggled because I didn't know what science was. I didn't know how to become a scientist. And when I found the developmental biology community, they welcomed me with open arms and provided so many opportunities. So I think that it starts at the ground level with the community. But then Twitter was a really fantastic way for people to stay connected when we were all at home and we couldn't be in person. And I think that Mr. Taylor mentioned that, you know, you can't get the same kind of connection online that you can in person. And I totally agree. But I think that social media was a great avenue to connect people when we couldn't be together. And so it actually started with me. We all had to go home, but I have an axolotl colony. So axolotls are these salamanders that are derived from Lake Xochimilco near Mexico City. And they are almost extinct in the wild, but there are a number of research populations. So I have these animals and somebody had to take care of them. And so my students and I would independently come here and take care of the animals, even though we weren't supposed to be in the building, but we could for animal care. And while I was here, I just, you know, I fell in love with them all over again and started taking pictures of them in videos and posting them on Twitter so that people could follow the journey of Chonk the axolotl, who was one of my animals who I got as a tadpole. And then she grew into our famous axolotl. So that's where it all started.
That is viral in the very best way. So I'm all for that. You know, in the last minute or two that we have, Dr. Shaw, I mean, you have 99 science cafes under your belt. Tonight's going to be the 100th. What are some memorable moments? I know it's at a bar, but I would imagine it's not really like a rowdy crowd.
You know, normally not a rowdy crowd, for sure. I would say one very memorable one is that we were still in a pretty small venue, in sort of the back room of a bar in Davis. And we had a speaker, Bruce German, who is very accomplished. He's founded companies and he's been in the popular press a bit. And that, even though I'd been trying to connect with Insight to get on here, my good friend Ben Landis of Capital Science Communicators, I think, was able to help me network. And we then landed a spot on Insight with Bruce German. And so that night, there was kind of a mob scene. There were about 10 times as many people who wanted to come to Science Cafe than we could accommodate. I walked out into the bar and there were lots and lots of people trying to get into the small room. And I heard a bunch of people say, wow, I really wanted to see this tonight, but I guess I just have to leave. And so after spending years trying to get people to show up to this event, I was suddenly overwhelmed and I realized, wow, we need a bigger venue. So after sampling a few, we ended up at G Street and they've been very accommodating. It's been a wonderful place to have this event. And, you know, a little shout out to Josh Lawson, who's he's a server. He's the sound guy. He's also a bouncer. And that would just bring me to another memorable Science Cafe. On one occasion, one person did get a little rowdy and they had to be bounced. And so after Josh escorted them outside of G Street Wonder Bar, the entire Science Cafe crowd, you know, clapped and cheered him on.
I still think that's a pretty good track record. One out of, like, you know, 99. That's
one
not
out of 99, that, it's fine.
That's not so bad. Well, Dr. Shaw and Dr. Rogers, thank you for joining us. And I know it's going to be a great time tonight.
All right. Thanks so much for having us.
Dr. Jared Shaw is the founder and the host of the Davis Science Cafe, which is celebrating its 100th event this evening. And Dr. Crystal Rogers is an associate professor in the Department of Anatomy, Physiology, and Cell Biology at UC Davis and is tonight's guest speaker. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests and events at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. You can also email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Claire Morgan. Insight's technical director and engineer is Mark Jones. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.